All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuckineers? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. It's my show. I host it in my garage in Highland Park, California, here at the Cat Ranch. There are several cats around. Right now, scaredy cat, wild cat, been feeding for a decade, just finished up eating and not talking to me. As usual, not having anything to do with me. After 10 fucking years of feeding that guy, you'd think maybe, come on over, touch me a little bit. Just a little touch on the head, be nice, nothing. Let me say hello to my friends across the pond and tell them that I will be in Dublin September 2nd at Vicker Street. Tickets are available if you go to WTFpod.com/calendar. There's a link there for you. September 3rd and 4th, I will be at Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, England. Again, a link at WTFpod.com/calendar. And those are the only gigs coming up because I finished up the Maron Nation tour this last weekend in Denver and in Boulder. Amazing shows. Me and Del Rey, Dean Del Rey. Boulder sold out. It was tremendous. What a great place that was. We did the Boulder Theater. We had a great time. And on Saturday night, we did the Paramount in Denver. Sold about 1350. Not bad for a guy who was me. Filled it out pretty nicely. Had a great show. Great time. I like Denver a lot. I'm back home, and now August is looking pretty empty, and I have to go back, and I got to start generating again, I guess. I have to go back to the drawing board. I've recorded this hour and a half chunk of material to get about an hour, I believe, for an Epic special that will be on in December on Epics called More Later. So I just looked at a director's cut for that Bobcat Goldthwait directed, and it looks great. I'm very happy with it. I'm very happy with things. But the fact is, I've just done an hour and a half that I've been doing for about 6 months to a year, and it might be time to let it go as it goes. It's a weird thing about doing stand-up these days. You got to turn over these hours. And I'm not sure. I always get to this point where I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do next. Where does the material come from? So maybe in August, I'm going to go out and do something exciting and compelling that'll generate at least an hour's material. And I think that might be jury duty. Because apparently, I'm the only asshole that responds to those things when they come in the mail. Everyone I've talked to, they're like, why'd you open the envelope? Because it's my duty as a citizen of the United States of America to be on a jury of my peers or whoever shows up and judge the problem at hand, the legal issue at hand. It's my responsibility. I've called that before and it didn't happen. I've been told that it might not happen because of my mid-level celebrity status. They might not want me, knowing that I was back in the day perhaps a lefty political spokesperson of sorts, or perhaps because I have a TV show where I appear to be cranky and a little bit angered. Or perhaps because I get on the mic twice a week and talk to you and talk to people in here. I don't know. But there's part of me that kind of wants to be on a jury. I know it can't be like the TV show. I know it's not going to be like 12 Angry Men. But maybe it will be. Who will I be? Will I be the Henry Fonda of the 12 Angry Men? Or will I be the Jack Warden, perhaps? Come on, let's get it over with. Will I be the Lee J. Cobb? He's guilty! He's guilty! I'm starting to think that all my impressions of men sound roughly the same. Slightly gravelly voice with a bit more intensity behind them, a bit more anger. If I'm excited about jury duty or the possibility of jury duty, I definitely have to engage on some other level in my life. I've been thinking about maybe doing some service work, doing something to get me out in the world where I feel like I help people on a day-to-day basis, not just talk. I know the talk helps people. I had a very touching moment in Denver. A kid came up to me, said he read both my books several times, and it helped him get a year's worth of sobriety. He was in a year outpatient program, and he's doing well. And that shit just, you know, it breaks my heart and makes me feel good that what I'm doing or how much of myself I'm putting out there makes a difference to people and helps people. I know that to be true, and I'm very grateful that I have that effect. But you know, again, if I'm excited for jury duty, there's something missing. Because I had this moment where you're going to have some version of this moment when you reach a certain age, where me and Dean were out. We're in Denver. We're having a good time. We go to this place called Black and Red Records. It's one of these old school places. They have books. They have records. They have games. There's stacks of shit all over the place. There's thousands of things, T-shirts, posters, classic place. And we had a really good time. I usually get overwhelmed and I can't go through record bins forever, but this place had records that I'd never seen before, old records I'd never seen before. So we both spent some money. They're going to ship us our records. Then we go to another place, and this is where the moment happens. We go to Wax Tracks in Denver, another great kind of old, dirty record store. It's got a lot of shit. I get into this conversation with Dean. I found an Earl Swick record. I'm like, I know that name. Guitar player, right? Who'd he play with? And Dean goes, I think it was in Bowie's last band, right? And I'm like, I don't think so. And then some dude who I look at, and he's like a little taller than me, he's got a beard, but it just seemed to be another version of me, or the surface of me, or the me that interfaces with records at a record store, the me that does that for fun. Is it just another version of that? And he goes, yeah, he was in Bowie's band. And I felt a little put off at first, but I'm glad that he knew. And then I look around the store. There's no less than four or five dudes look exactly like me, different version, slight variations, all approaching 50 or in their 50s or in their 40s, just poking around in record bins, looking to connect with some part of themselves that had to do that because we had no choice. Just poking around in record bins because that's how we travel. That's how we time travel. That's how we go back. So this is like some fairly common midlife event, poking around in record bins, looking for something that worked back when we were younger, or maybe get that same feeling we got when we were younger, maybe a better feeling, maybe something elevated, something defining. I don't know. I don't know what we're looking for in those record bins, but I know there's no fucking end to it. And then I saw this dude talking to his 8-year-old, maybe not, probably 6-year-old daughter. I was at a bin, and he was down a few bins from me. And he's got the Some Girls record, the Rolling Stones record out, and he's trying to explain to this 6-year-old girl why the covers are different. He told, you know, the whole story is that before they had all the faces, Lucille Ball, I think Marilyn Monroe, a bunch of women's faces in the slide out, but they had to take them off because they didn't get rights to those faces. So I just see this father saying, Lucille Ball, they didn't pay her or ask her if they could use her face. And I was just thinking, like, how much of that little girl is picking that stuff at Lucille Ball or even making sense of it all? Maybe she's a bright little girl, but still, there was something endearing but a little weird about it, because when Dean and I are leaving, he's got her over at the listening station. This little girl's got the headphones on, and I just see her standing there next to her dad, and she's holding the Sgt. Pepper's cover and listening, and he goes, I'm trying to get her started on the good stuff. And I, you know, part of me was, I said, we'll try to keep her out of the rabbit hole that we're in because I don't think there's any end to it. And he laughed, and I noticed that he had a crate of about 30 or 40 records. So I guess his desperation to connect with whatever we lost was a little more intense than mine, and he's got a kid. So maybe that's not the answer. Jason Segel is on the show today. I'm a big fan of Jason Segel's. I've been wanting to talk to him for a long time. I think he seems like a sweet guy. I feel like we have some things in common. I don't know. That might just be a Jewish thing that I projected onto to him. I still have that thing in my mind where I can identify and connect with almost any Jew of my ilk. And clearly I can connect with other people, but it's a weird thing. But I just like the guy, and he's in a great movie that I just watched, a very interesting independent movie called The End of the Tour. And it's about David Foster Wallace. It's about this writer who wrote an article on him, played by Jesse Eisenberg. Guy's name is David Lipsky. And it's a very subtle, kind of bizarre movie. But Jason does a great job, and it's an interesting role from him. Many of you know him from his movies, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, This Is 40, the Muppet movie. You know him from How I Met Your Mother. You know him. He's very funny. He's got a great way about him, and I was excited to talk to him, and we had a good talk, and that's going to happen in your head shortly. I was just in Hawaii last week. Very exciting. I was flown out to do a scene in a movie. It's called Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, I believe is the name of the movie. I was asked to do it by the director, and they flew me down for the day. Luxurious, very exciting to fly down to Honolulu, which I've never been to, for a day's work, where I played a bar owner, and I did a scene with Zac Efron and Adam Devine. And I've not done that many movies, and it's the opening scene of the movie, if all goes well, but we don't know. I don't know. I don't know where we did some riffing. It was fun. I had a good time for the day. I wore someone else's clothes, and I stayed at a hotel where they had dolphins in a pool. So we'll see how that goes. I got nothing to complain about, folks. I'm just, you know, it just starts up again. It's time to sort of, where am I at? What am I doing? How do I create? How do I find some space for myself to think? I'm tired of fucking Twitter. I'm tired of engaging. So, onward we go. Thank you all for being there. Right now, let's talk to Jason Segel.
You look like you just got a haircut.
Yeah, I got a summertime haircut.
Did you go to the razor place?
I went to my local little barber, and I embarrassingly showed them a picture of David Beckham.
You did?
Yeah, I said, give me the Beckham.
You want the Beckham?
I wanted the Beckham.
I think you're a little late on the Beckham, aren't you?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I caught it when it's totally unhip.
Yeah. Wait, so you moved to Los Feliz?
Yeah.
So did you go to like Sweeney Todd, or who'd you go to?
No, you know what? I have a place up near Santa Barbara.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a little small town. So I went over there.
Is it like one of those old-timey barbershops, or is it just like a hairstyle salon?
It's a salon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, yeah. Fine. But you're native here, right?
Yeah, I grew up in the Palisades.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, it was a nice way to grow up.
I don't know if I've ever really spent any time there.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it on television.
There's not totally a reason to spend time there.
But it's like, it's just all the way west. Big, yeah. You know, I went to Joan Rivers' daughter's house to do her show.
Yeah.
Did you ever do that in bed with Joan show?
No.
You sat there on her bed with Joan Rivers.
Wow.
And she interviewed you.
How did that go?
It was fine.
Yeah.
She's a dirty old lady.
Right. Yeah,
she was amazing. She'd talk about anything.
Yeah.
She'd throw anybody under the bus.
Yeah. I've done that, but never on radio or anything.
Gone to someone's house and interviewed on their bed.
Just dirty old ladies talking.
What was your family like? I mean, you grew up in the Palisades. That's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. I have an older brother, kid sister.
You do? You have an older brother?
Yeah, I have an older brother named Adam. He's the best. He was my idol growing up.
Really? And you have a little sister?
Yeah.
And you're all, like, you grew up Jewish?
Well, it's interesting you ask. My father's Jewish. My mother is Christian.
Yeah.
So I grew up going to a school called St. Matthew's during the day, and then I would walk to Hebrew school at night.
So they wanted you to do both. But your mom didn't want to convert, but your dad wanted to have some Jew in you.
You know what? Neither of them are religious.
Sure.
So they made this decision that they were going to let me decide.
Yeah.
Which is like it's the dumbest thing you can do for a kid.
Right, right.
You don't really care.
Yeah, or why would you do anything unless there's something in it for you?
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember, this is when you become funny.
Like, yeah.
You know. When I was like 13, it was time for my bar mitzvah.
Right.
So I invited all the kids from the Christian school.
Yeah.
And then the headmaster came up and he said, you know, everyone is very excited about your big party, but the kids don't really know what a bar mitzvah is. Would you stand up in front of the school at communion?
Jew.
And explain what a bar mitzvah is. So then you cut to the next day, little 13-year-old Jason Segel standing there like, on Saturday, I become a man. And it's literally a direct cut to getting punched in the face. I mean, it's not how you want to do it.
What, you got flack?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They didn't. I was like an odd kid growing up in general.
Yeah.
Long hair. I've been 6'4 since I was like 12.
Oh, so you're like the awkward kid. Awkward, sensitive
kid. Yeah.
Not comfortable?
No, completely uncomfortable. And then actually, it's how I got started. My parents put me into acting class, not for acting, but because I was very shy.
Therapeutic.
Yeah. They thought maybe you'll meet some other weird kids.
Right.
And I totally did. And there was this thing that they said, you have Fozzie Bear on your wall.
Yeah, someone drew that of me interviewing Fozzie, but I can't do anything with it because it's copyrighted. So that couldn't even be published, but the artist sent it to me.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was a big Muppet Show fan, and there is a line in one of the Muppet movies where someone says, a bunch of weirdos make a family.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt like when I went to acting class. Like, oh, okay, no one is making fun of me here. Let's do this.
Right, the theater nerds kind of.
Totally.
And whose acting class was it?
It was a place called the Santa Monica Playhouse.
Yeah, was there anyone else in your class that went on to do things? I don't feel like someone mentioned that before.
Yeah, a lot of people went through there, but nobody really that I can think of.
Cuz I had Martin Starr in here.
Yeah.
And he started young.
Yep.
But, he grew up in Santa Monica, I think.
Yeah, and I would imagine for similar reasons. Like, Martin is a really interesting, different, unique kind of guy.
Sensitive dude.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's when it started. So how old were you?
I was probably about 10 years old, 11 years old.
So before the bar mitzvah. So by the time you had the big break explaining what a bar mitzvah was, a little stage time under your belt.
I wasn't scared to get up in front of the crowd, but then I was scared when they beat me up.
But it's weird, too, as a Jew or as a, being brought up Jewish, you don't necessarily know exactly. You know, you're just becoming a man, but then you got to explain the ritual. And did you do the whole thing? Like I have to read from the Torah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I did the whole thing, but I viewed it like a performance. I went up and like really made a show of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I was dressing really weird at the time. And I wore like a purple suit and mustard pants.
Mustard pants.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely.
I like mustard. I had mustard pants.
You did? Yeah.
I did recently.
Oh, cool.
I had mustard corduroys. I was very attached to them.
Yeah, yeah.
You
well,
don't
corduroys
see
work. Yeah, they looped back around mustard pants.
Yeah, yeah. I always liked that color. So they all looked at you like an oddball.
Yeah, I think at that point you just make a decision, especially, also at Christian school, you're the Jewish kid, and at Hebrew school, you're the Christian kid. I think that's the nature of groups.
You're not a real Jew.
Yeah.
Is your mom Jewish? No, you're not a real Jew.
Right. And so everyone wants to compartmentalize people. And I think I decided at that point, like, okay, it's me versus the world, kind of.
Yeah. And you sought some comfort in the acting class and in Muppets.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Because that's like, who was I talking to? Judd, I guess. And, You have this reverence for the Muppets.
Yeah.
To the point where you're like, we need to make a new Muppet movie. I mean, you made that happen.
Yeah, well, I cared a lot about it and I helped make it happen. I think that what always
How's it unfold?
Okay. I wrote a movie called Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yeah. I like that movie.
Thanks, man. And
I saw you naked in that movie.
Yeah. Totally.
Weird, interesting decision.
Thanks. Well, at the time, it was like a very new decision. I feel like now it's like no one bats an eye, but I thought, well, there was actually a reason. It's the same reason that I was going to get to
about the
puppets is that the thing about a romantic comedy, I think, is that you know what's going to happen. Like the guy on the poster is going to end up with the girl on the poster.
Right.
And some people can take pleasure in that journey, but like a lot of men, for instance, kind of roll their eyes at it. It's just not an interesting thing. So I thought that if you opened a movie where main guy is naked in the first scene, basically, you're kind of forced to let go of any expectations. Like, I don't know what's going to happen,
Yeah.
So then the challenge is, how do you end a movie like that when you know they're going to end up together? And I've been obsessed with the Muppets. And I said to Judd, like, what if we end this with a lavish puppet musical? And he literally looked at me and said, it's your movie, man. And we did. And I love it. It's like one of my favorite things that I've ever managed to trick people into doing. And from there, like something goes well and then you have a little bit of juice.
Yeah.
So people were asking, what are you going to do next? And I said, I'd like to bring back the Muppets. And everyone said, you're crazy. What? Why? This is a totally different thing than what we like you doing. But I just I went in and I pitched it to Disney, and they said okay. And then I set off doing that.
And you wrote it.
I wrote it. Yeah, I wrote it with my friend Nick Stoller.
I know Nick Stoller.
Oh yeah, he's the
best. He was in here.
He was.
Yeah,
yeah. He's the best dude.
Yeah, you guys it makes sense. You're sweet guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. He's a good really friend nice of yours. Guy.
Yeah, he directed Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
That's right.
Yeah, we did. He wrote Muppets with me, and we did a movie called 5-Year Engagement together. So we worked a lot together.
But the Muppet thing was just off the. It was just out of a childhood love of the Muppets.
Yeah, it was that, and also
there hadn't been one in a while.
Hadn't
right?
been one in a long time, and I felt like one of the things the Muppets did that was really unique and special is they never made fun of people. They never got laughs at other people's expense.
Right.
I just thought that combined with this idea that they're so strange was a really neat thing. Like
they're so strange because they're puppets?
No, because they're they're a frog and a bear and Gonzo's or whatever, and they all kind of come together. And I felt like you can catch a kid at a certain age and instill this idea that it's okay. Whatever you are is okay.
Right.
And like in today, I don't know, I think a lot about this stuff, but in today's world, like there's so much shaming and everything's either a major win or a total fail on
right,
the internet.
Right, right, right.
That some voice saying, it's okay.
Yeah.
Was important.
And it was important to you.
Yeah, totally.
When you were a kid.
Yeah.
Because you felt out of place.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, that's wild, man. So when did you, like, if you started taking those acting classes at 10 or 11,
yeah,
when did it become a real thing? What does your brother do, by the way?
So my brother is a money manager, you know, investment banker type thing.
Uh-huh.
Really smart, real alpha male. He was like a great athlete in high school. Really wanted to be just like him. And so I like delved into basketball and became a pretty good basketball player.
Okay.
In high school.
Yeah.
And I won the state championship and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you play now?
No, I haven't played in a long time. I'd like to start playing again.
You don't just go shoot?
No, but I'm going to start. I'm going to start.
Some fellas.
Yeah, no.
Shanling used to have a game back in the day.
Yeah, I heard that. There's a lot of guys who have games. I haven't been invited to those, but I'll go.
Well, maybe I'd put it out there.
Yeah, like, put it out there. I'd love to play some basketball with some dudes.
Do you do that? Do you socialize much?
Yeah, I'm getting much better about it. I'm making a concerted effort to socialize.
You have to,
more.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
I just realized that recently. It's like no one's just gonna, you know, call you up.
Yeah.
And like, unless you're sort of like, I'm available to do things.
You know, it's interesting. This is a tangent, but yeah. I feel as though the same impulses and nature that like got me to where I got to ended up kind of turning on me at some point where I'm just like, I was really driven. And I had this idea that the only way you're going to make it is if you just make it happen and work your ass off. And so at night I would go home and write, and I would watch comedy and study it and watch acting and think about it and this and that. And then at some point, like, you know, you have this idea of I need to get there.
Right.
But then you find out there keeps moving.
Right.
And so if your impulse is I need to get there, that's never going to go away. And
exactly.
So, yeah. It's been the past few years when I've realized like, oh, you're good. Like everything's going great. And let's focus on life stuff.
Well, that's interesting. How old are you?
35.
Well, yeah. So it's good timing.
Yeah.
You haven't fucked it all away.
No, thank God. No, I mean, it's really true, man. I have like, if I'm lucky, I got 50 years left.
Sure, man.
Of good times.
Like, you know, if you can hang on to this this new attitude, you might enjoy life.
Yeah, and I also have like a hunch that we might be the first generation that gets an extra 20 years.
Yeah?
Yeah, like science might help us out.
You're going to go to 100?
Yeah, maybe I'll go to 100.
Let me just the basic question is how the genetics, how did grandma and grandpa do age wise?
They did well. Also, my father, who is the best guy in the world, but you know, he's like a 5'10" short, squat Jewish guy, married like a beautiful 5'11" Irish woman.
Okay.
And I got those genetics.
Oh, you did?
It seems that way.
Oh, yeah. Good. So that's great. So, all right. Well, so you're 10 or 11, and your sister, they all live in town still?
My brother lives in Boston. He just bought a place in like Central Coast. And my sister lives in LA, yeah.
Oh, so everyone's here.
Everyone's
do you do
here.
Dinners and shit?
Yeah. We get along much better now than we did like in my 20s.
Oh, yeah?
Area. Yeah, I think, you know, sibling relationships are tricky.
Yeah.
And then you arrive at some, it's the same thing that happened with my feelings about my parents. At some point you realize that everybody is just doing their best.
They are, but it's hard to accept, isn't it?
Yeah, but
especially with parents.
Yeah. Well, when it seems like so obvious, but at some point I realized my parents were strangers who met each other.
Right.
That they weren't this unit.
Yeah.
That had been there from the beginning of time.
And they were just young people with their own insecurities,
totally,
and their own weirdness.
Met each other, doing their best, trying to figure out how to do it. Everybody's just guessing.
And they're still together.
Yeah, they're still together.
That's a miracle.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, it doesn't happen to most people.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
And what's your sister do?
My sister's a writer as well. She's really, really funny.
Oh, really? She's a comedy writer?
Yeah.
Has she done movies?
No, she hasn't done movies yet. She's written articles and blogs and things like that, and she's writing screenplays now.
Ah.
Yeah.
I hope she can get those read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, totally.
Yeah, it's going to be, yeah, I don't know if she's going to have an avenue to get her stuff out there.
Yeah. They're like,
that day's coming, buddy.
I think that I grow more and more aware how lucky I was to meet Judd Apatow.
Sure. Yeah, he's kind of something else, you know? Like, I don't know where he finds all the time. And also a very giving and sweet dude on top of having a million things going on.
He changed my life.
Well, so let's go back to that. So you're doing acting, and you've studied at 10 or 11 years old.
So at this point, I'm playing basketball in high school, and I saw in school that I have like a very good memory. You know, short-term, can memorize stuff. And I was doing a little bit of acting, but I was focused on sports, and I decided that I would read this play for no reason. I read this play called The Zoo Story.
Yeah, Edward Albee.
Yeah, that's right. And there was like a 20-page monologue in it.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'd like to see if I can memorize this. Yeah. That was really my thinking at the time.
Right.
And so I asked the head of the theater department, Ted Walsh, do you mind if I try putting on this play?
And this is in Palisades,
at
high school?
This is at Harvard Westlake in the Valley.
Okay.
Yeah. And he said, yeah, sure. You know, you can use the small theater to do two nights. And so I put it on, and this is some real LA stuff, but there was a woman who came to see the show who turned out to be president of casting at Paramount Pictures.
Right.
And like a week later, my parents sat me down and they said, listen, we need to talk. We've been talking to this lady all week. And if you want, she thinks that you might have a future in acting. So you have a big decision to make.
So this was a fluke. You decide you want to try to memorize this thing. And the Zoo Story, as I recall, is a lot of monologues, right?
Yeah, it's a guy and on a park bench, and another guy walks up, and it's two people talking.
She reached out to your parents because you're what, 15?
I was 16 at the time. Yeah, I reached out to my parents, and I decided, I'll give it a try. And so my senior year, I just started auditioning. And I did a couple like teen movies, one movie called Dead Man on Campus, like some like kind of dumb teen stuff.
Yeah.
And then I did a little independent movie called SLC Punk. Uh-huh. It was the first kind of acting that I...
What was that movie? I don't know that movie.
It was about...
But that's not...
It was a little niche movie about punk music in Salt Lake City in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And then this script came across... It was my first pilot season.
Right.
And a script came across my desk called Freaks and Geeks.
Right.
And I immediately thought, no way, this sounds like a Nickelodeon show.
Right.
And they were like, no, this guy's Judd Apatow. And he had done Larry Sanders Show at that point, but he wasn't Judd yet.
Yeah, you know? And Paul Feig, right?
And Paul Feig, yeah. And they said, no, you should go in for this. And so I went in, and it was my first time improvising. And
who did he put you with? Was it one-on-one or was he...
It was me and the casting director. But I think I had the naivety of youth. Like, I just thought, okay, I'll go do this.
Right.
And I'm pretty smart, you know, and whatever. So I did the thing. And then next thing I knew, my life changed. We started doing Freaks and Geeks, and I was surrounded by, it was just like my first acting class, and just like the Muppets, a bunch of weirdos make a family. There's no better place than Freaks and Geeks for it to feel that way.
Yeah,
again.
Yeah.
And then we were just in it, man. And then at one point, Judd took me aside, me and Seth Rogen and all of us, I'm sure. And he said, if you can improv the way you can, then you can write.
Uh-huh.
That's what writing is. You're just going to do it in a more focused, like deliberate way. And he literally taught me how to write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine the relationship that people have with Freaks and Geeks. And there's only, what, 18 of them.
Yeah.
Right? It's pretty profound. Like, I came to it much later. I mean, there were people that grew up with it, but I'm old. I'm 51, so I sort of missed it. So I had my first experience with it within the last, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Sure.
I watched the whole thing.
Oh, cool.
And it's interesting because, you know, knowing all of you guys as actors established, watching that, I'm like, oh, look at the kids. I know. So sweet.
Yeah. It was, I think that one of the reasons people connect to it is... everybody has this sense, no matter how good they are at faking it, that they are like different than their peers, you know?
Yeah.
And that show is really about that.
Right.
Yeah, it was really special. Everybody was kind of like digging deep into what it feels like not to feel comfortable.
Yeah, and do you, you know, outside of like Seth, because I have this weird thing that keeps getting shattered every time I have people who were in like important ensemble shows or movies that they just always stay in touch. Like when I see people in movies, I'm like, you must talk to that guy still. You guys are, you know, buddies on the screen.
Yeah. Well, I think that we do talk, you know, less as you get older and people right. have their own lives and things like that. But, Seth and I wrote together for a long time and, you know, we always send each other emails wishing each other well. And same with a lot of the other people in the cast. But yeah, I think you grow apart by nature of time.
Sure. It's interesting where people show up, you know, over time, like to see what's her name in Mad Men. What's her name?
Linda.
Again? Yeah. I mean, it was like, hey, there she is.
Yeah.
She's in the, and like, I obviously have limited experience in show business, but as somebody who watches shows, there's that moment where you're like, oh, she's working. That's great.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's also, when Freaks and Geeks got canceled after the first year, you're so young that you have this idea that that's how it always goes.
Right.
So you're kind of like, all right, well, I'm on to the next groundbreaking show.
Right.
And then you get some time. Like I plunged right into 3 years of being out of work. And so then.
Really?
Yeah, that's when I started writing. I was all of a sudden at this age where.
So you were like, what, 17, 18?
And at that point, I was like 20 to 23. That age, I had no work.
So, okay, so you were going to be an actor, and you were an actor.
And I didn't go to college.
Right.
You know, in order to act.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, I was now like too old to play a kid anymore, and too young to be like the doctor.
Right. And Martin had that. He had a similar situation where things just, you know, changed, and he had to reevaluate.
Yeah. And that's when Judd said, the only way you're going to make it is if you start writing your own material, you know, like kind of the Albert Brooks model where,
right.
you know, no one's banging down your door to be like the romantic lead in something
yet.
Yeah. You know, so you better do it. And I just started writing.
What did you start writing?
First thing I wrote was a script called, it was called at the time Nightmares Beware, which I've now turned into a series of kids books that are out called Nightmares.
Yeah.
10 years later. And then I wrote.
How are they selling?
Yeah, they did pretty good. I don't really. It's not my main job, so I don't follow it with that kind of eye.
Right. It wasn't. Out, you were just doing it because you wanted to.
Yeah,
right.
It made the bestseller list, but I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's 1,000 books or 100 books, or I don't know what it is.
I think it's. Well, how long did you publish them?
The first one came out in September. The next one comes out this September.
Well, you'll find out.
Yeah,
they'll send you the weird little things. Like when you do a book, well, it sounds like it did all right, but a lot of times when you get a deal to do a book, and then you know after they you get these quarterly things that basically you know show how many you've sold against your deal. So for a decade, I've just gotten I still owe them money apparently.
Yeah, totally. Is there a way to work it off?
Well, it's just the way they frame it. You don't have to give your money back or anything, but they you know they show you just how many units you've sold. And what it is compared to what they gave you.
Yeah.
And it's never, well, for me, it wasn't necessarily encouraging, but people got the book.
Yeah. I'd like to kind of even it up if I owe them money with like some one man shows or I can appear at a dinner party.
All right. Maybe it might be selling great.
Yeah. No, I think it did well. I have a framed New York Times bestseller list thing.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. But, you know, that wasn't really why I did it.
But that was the first screenplay.
That was the first screenplay. And then the next.
What was the pitch? What was the angle?
It's about a kid whose it's like Roald Dahl style. It's about a kid whose mother passes away, and when his dad gets remarried, he starts having terrible nightmares and about witches. And so one night, he and his friends have to journey into the nightmare world, each face their biggest fear in order to rescue the kid's brother.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
That's cool.
It makes sense that it'd be a good kid's book.
Yeah.
So it's for ages like eight, late.
Eight and up, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know how I just nailed that.
No. Oh.
The age thing.
Smart guy. You've been doing this a long time.
Well, I just sort of like, I was like, okay, what age would that stop being terrifying?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Right?
Well, I think that kids really like to be scared.
Right.
And I just remember at that age, I liked being pushed right to the edge where I felt like, I can't believe my parents are letting me do this.
Right, right, right. Do they know?
Yes.
Right.
Totally. Yeah. Meanwhile, your parents are like having Chardonnay in the living room.
They don't know something scares you till you come out of your room crying.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I was apparently scared by a lot then, by the way.
Were you? Everything.
Everything scared me.
Just coming out of the room.
Measure, if coming out of the room crying is the measure of fear.
I felt that a lot. I don't know, because I grew up in, middle class, upper middle class Jewish household. But I did feel like I was too sensitive.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what that is. I guess my parents were okay, but they were a little self-involved.
Sure.
I don't know what you grew up in or what made you sensitive or whether you can track it, but it's not everybody's. And you had this brother who was just an animal, it sounds like.
Well, I think that you find out everyone you think has it put together has their own stuff. You know what I mean?
That's later.
Yeah.
Because you spend your life assuming like that guy's got to, he has it together.
Yeah. Well, when you're 12 years old, you're the center of your own world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that world's going to crumble if that's the world you've built for yourself.
Yeah. I don't know what made me sensitive. I think I've always felt things very acutely.
I think that's what I feel from you when in your roles, because I don't know you, but I always assumed that guy seems like a pretty sweet guy. Seems like things hit him pretty hard somehow.
Yeah, I've cried a lot in yeah. comedies. I think I've cried more in comedies.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
But what was it? What was the second thing you wrote?
The second thing I wrote was a movie called Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
That was it? So you wrote that when you were in your 20s?
Yeah, I was 24 when I wrote that.
So that hung around for a while?
No, I made that movie when I was 25.
It's been that long?
Yeah. I think it 7 years, so I might be off by a year, but something like that. Yeah, 25, 26.
But by that point, you'd already acted in some Judd movies, right? Or no?
I had done Knocked Up, and then I had started my TV show, How I Met Your Mother. We can measure it that way, actually. The Forgetting Sarah Marshall was the second year of the TV show.
Okay.
So I was 26.
God, did you have any idea that TV show would go on as long as it did?
No, I had no idea. My only experience had been failed TV shows. And the first 3 years or so, we were on the bubble and constantly on the verge of being canceled. And so then it just kept, it found its legs like season 4 or 5. And then we were going, man.
You did like what, 9?
9 seasons, like 240 episodes or something like that.
And that's like your made guy.
I certainly had a real safety net of knowing I had a great job.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can save some money.
Yeah,
and you're
totally
going to be all right.
Yeah.
Can get a house.
Right, yeah,
live
totally.
Live a life.
The fear of not having gone to college went away.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, but it went away fairly quickly in a way. Not, I mean, within a decade is good, because you don't want to be the decade down the line going, fuck.
Yeah. The 3 years, though, when I was
20
out of
to
work,
23,
something like that, really instilled this thing in me, like we were talking about before, where you better work your ass off.
Well, there's panic. Especially when things don't work out.
Totally.
Like, so I imagine after Freaks and Geeks, you're going on auditions.
Yeah.
And you're just like not getting shit.
Yeah. No, totally. And there is a sense that it's insurmountable.
Right. Oh, yeah. And then you're beating up on yourself. I mean, totally. What were your parents saying during that time?
I didn't totally fill them in as to how scared I was, I don't think.
But were they like, well, you can go to college?
I think at one point that was brought up.
One point?
Yeah. But what's really funny about my mentality at that point was, to me, the alternatives were, I'm either going to make it as an actor and a writer, or I'm going to move back into my parents' house. Like, the notion of get a regular job wasn't sort
right.
of in my...
You had no experience with it. There was no reason for you to know that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a weird thing about growing up in a house where, your father was what?
He's a lawyer.
Oh, well, so, I mean, you must have had that somewhere in your head. Like, you could be a lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I did. I just, you know what? Okay.
What?
Here's the thing. I think that anyone who's a performer
is
a very unique personality type.
Right.
In that you believe somewhere that what you have to express artistically is worthy of people paying money for and being quiet and listening to.
You felt that.
I felt like I had something to offer.
early on. This is when you were 20.
Yeah, I felt like I could do something. I think you have to.
You have a calling.
Yeah, you have a calling, or you have something to say, or you have a unique skill. I think if you don't have that, I don't know why you're doing it. You're just getting beat up the whole time.
Right.
Like, you better have this feeling that you have something to offer. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who feel that way and turn out to be wrong.
Right.
And it's, you know, I guess that would be a delusion, but...
There's some of that is necessary in this business.
I think so.
Yeah, a little bit.
Too many people are trying to do it. I mean, people arrive by the busload from their town to try to, like, make it.
Well, now, and also it's become so diversified in that, like, if you have an iPhone and you can post, there is something now where I think that delusion, you know, without any indication of ability, can be nurtured forever.
Yeah,
it's sort of heartbreaking in some ways, but you can't begrudge anyone for trying, because who the fuck knows, you know? But it is a little bit. I said it on stage the other night that you know, when you do comedy and you see all the headshots of people that you don't know, like you don't recognize. You've seen that when you go to a casting or something, just see stacks of headshots of just people like, hey, like me, where it's sort of, there's a pain to it.
Oh, you know, when you're auditioning too, there's this other totally demoralizing aspect of walking into this casting room with 20 other guys who look exactly like you.
Yeah. and the decision's not going to be made based on anything but, like, you know, that guy looks right, or like, I like the way he read that line, or it might not have anything to do with what you're really capable of.
Yeah, I lived in New York for a tiny bit during that period, and
the 3 years?
Around there when I was auditioning, and it was in August.
Yeah.
And it was like
sweaty,
July,
hot,
August.
And gross.
Yeah. So I would go to these auditions. I didn't have a car, obviously. And by the time I would arrive at the audition, I would just be drenched in sweat, like looking like a monster. And I remember thinking, like, this model is not going to work.
Yeah. Now, well, how long did you live in New York?
I only lived in New York for like a few months, like 4 or 5 months.
What was that about? Was that a failed adventure? Or?
Yeah, well, I had met a girl at that age, and I went to go. I decided I was going to go try to live with her in her apartment that had no air conditioning, and it was like great in the spring, and then by the time it hit summer, it was like a Tennessee Williams play
with the fan in the window.
You hate each other, and you're dripping with sweat.
Oh yeah,
talking in a weird Southern accent for no reason.
Yeah, and her dad shows up, and the disturbing relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
But so that crumbled.
Yeah, that crumbled. I came back to LA.
Ran back to LA.
I did.
Where the temperature is level.
Yeah, it's just a little more moderate for a guy my size, you know.
that's the reason.
Yeah.
But Forgetting Sarah Marshall was big, and I enjoyed that movie. I watched it a couple times.
Thanks.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of your movies. I'm surprised. This doesn't always happen.
Oh, that's good. That beats the alternative.
Well, because sometimes you talk to people, and it's interesting when people have, like, and you're fairly young, but you've done a lot of stuff, but, like, sometimes I get musicians in here, and, like, I like that one record when I was younger, and then you look them up, and they're like, they've done 90 records.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have an interesting thing where, like, a few years ago, I really... remove myself from, like, entertainment news or paying attention to what was current or this and that.
Yeah.
Because I realized I felt better that way.
Right.
And so I have that experience a lot where I meet somebody and I don't know what they do. Or
right.
Whatever.
Oh, yeah. It's nicer sometimes.
I think so. Because you can have just talk to them on a human level.
Well, what it really comes down to for me in this context, which is not that much different because I don't, you know, I can't pretend.
Right.
Is that, I find that, you know, if you're going to meet somebody in a professional situation, if they did something amazing, maybe you should know about it just out of respect.
Right.
You know, like, you don't want to be talking to the guy that cured AIDS.
Right, sure.
And just be like, so you got a dog?
Yeah.
You
know, yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, all right. So after Forgetting Sarah Marshall, where you were naked, and I don't want to get hung up on that.
Sure.
But you don't see a lot of dicks on screen.
Yeah.
Was that a relatively sober decision or?
It was a sober decision and not a sober filming process.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I had to drink to get the courage to walk out there. It was a very uncomfortable scenario for everybody, really.
Yeah.
First of all, there's like this makeup woman, this poor makeup woman who like, it has to do full body makeup on you, which is a really humiliating experience. And then they...
How did you feel about, you know, were you confident in your dick before that? I mean, were you like, I'm okay. This is not embarrassing.
Well, I wanted it to be embarrassing.
Okay.
I didn't want it to be sexy.
Right.
I felt like that would be gross.
Right, right.
I wanted it to feel very vulnerable.
Right.
You know?
It doesn't get much more, I mean, in terms of like...
Yeah, well, it's also during like a humiliating breakup scene.
Right.
So
right.
It was like...
It's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. And so I think I wanted it to feel as uncomfortable as possible.
Right.
I would sneak into the back of theaters to watch it, and literally people, like, were disgusted.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, I haven't thought about this for a long time.
So you don't see a lot of dicks.
Yeah, totally. I mean, depending on the kind of movie you watch.
Right, but yeah. in a mainstream
film. So there are these test screenings they mm-hmm. do for movies where they have like a bring in a test audience and then at the end they have to answer questions.
Right.
So I went to the back of the first test screening, the first movie I've ever written, the first movie I've been the main guy in, and the movie goes great. Like people are laughing really hard. It plays as well as you could hope that it could
play. Right.
And I'm sitting in the back and the Q&A starts and there's this guy. He's like, so what did you think of the romantic storyline? Oh, it's great. Oh, Mila Kunis is so winning. You know, it's just everyone's saying the right things. And then they finish. They're like, all right, great. Well, thank you. Any final comments? And one guy raises his hand and goes, yeah. Is nobody going to talk about this guy's weird dick? It's like the one guy had to ruin my thing.
His weird dick?
Yeah. Test audiences always have that. We did a test audience.
What did he mean?
Who knows? I don't know what he's used to
did
seeing.
Did it make you look at your dick differently?
I guess.
What is weird about my dick?
At Muppets test screening, they showed it to a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
And had them fill out questionnaires at the end. My character's name was Gary. And so the questionnaire is, they framed one for me, like an 8-year-old kid, and they said, what did you like about the movie? And he wrote, Muppets are funny. Muppets sing songs.
Yeah.
What did you not like about the movie? Gary's face.
God.
Yeah.
And that kid, that's a guy who grows up to be like, and no one's going to talk about his weird dick?
Yeah. Yeah, same guy.
Yeah.
Totally.
So outside of the acting you took when you were a kid, did you work with coaches and did you continue to train at all?
No, I feel like at that point it felt more like on the job training, and working with Judd felt like an apprenticeship in a lot of ways. But I was paying attention and I was watching performances and feeling inspired by them.
Like by who? Like you mean at home? Like,
because
you said when you were in your ambitious, compulsive phase that you were watching actors.
I remember watching Edward Norton in Primal Fear when I was young.
Whoa.
Yeah, I was like 17 when that came out or something.
That's where he plays the murderer?
Yeah, it's his first
Richard
movie.
Gere?
Yeah.
Right.
I remember thinking, that's what I want to do.
And serious shit.
Yeah, I just, that's where I was at the time. And the Zoo Story is a drama.
Yeah.
And then I'm incredibly lucky. I met Judd and I got swept into a comedy world.
Right.
And I turned out to be good at it. And so you start doing what you're good at and what people are used to seeing you as. But I think all during this period, I was starting to develop an itch that I wanted to try to do stuff that was more honest.
Well, the new movie definitely is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can move up to that. All through the comedies, like, what is it about, did you find, because I mean, I'm a comic and you have a very unique comic timing. And that was what was interesting about the way Judd sort of let you guys evolve in Freaks and Geeks, because there's a very unique comic timing to everybody, but it is definitely comic. But he let you guys find it. He must have had a sense of it. Because you and Seth and, you know, even Martin, you know, though you all played it very real, but there was a certain natural comedy to it.
You know, they did something that I've never heard of before. When they were casting Freaks and Geeks, they did like an international casting search essentially for weird kids.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And they did casting sessions in small towns and they went to Canada and went, you know, all these places besides just casting in LA. And I think that I think a lot of it is in the selection process and finding people. And those improv sessions, you're either going to be good at that or you're not.
Right.
You know, you can't really fake it.
Right.
And so I think it's one of the things Judd is great at. And Paul, if you watch their movies, they're just really good at finding people who can do that, who have a unique thing.
Right. Well, yeah. But did you find that, because it seems like that Knocked Up comedically is very different than Forgetting Sarah Marshall or I Love You, Man.
Yeah.
So, like, it's always a hard question to answer because you're not, I don't see that you've really been typecast in any way. You know, you're just, you find a certain tone of a character that kind of locks into your sense of humor. How do you feel that out?
Well, I appreciate that. I think that in the early part of my career, like when I was writing Forgetting Sarah Marshall,
yeah,
that was an attempt to be as uniquely my voice as I was capable of being.
Yeah, you're very vulnerable, and also you're the underdog, and you're emotionally desperate in a way.
Yeah, oh, totally. Right. It's actually a very, very honest movie, and there's like a drama underlying that movie. That is a guy who is really lost, doesn't feel good about himself, and drinking really heavily in that movie, and like trying to find his own inner strength, sort of. And then I felt like the best way to express that was through comedy. That's what I'm good at.
And is that where you were at in your life?
Yeah, I think I was. I think it progressed more. I started feeling that way more as the years went on.
As you got more successful.
Yeah, a little bit, in that I think, well, one thing that happens, I think, by nature of the business is that you start to have opportunities to do what you have done well again and again and again.
Yeah.
And I fell into that. And at the same time, to be easy on myself, I was doing How I Met Your Mother at the time. And so I was, for 9 years, I was filming a TV show during the year, writing the script that I would do that summer, and then filming a movie over the summer. And it was a real cycle where I don't think I took much time to stop and think about what I wanted.
Yeah, that makes complete sense.
You know what I mean?
Because you're caught up.
Yeah, you're caught up, and I had this vestigial fear that it could all go away.
Really?
Yeah, like if I take a summer off, will they forget me in the movie world?
Right.
You know, that impulse was still in me, and so I think that, and it's my own doing, but I think that I got caught up in a cycle of, okay, I found something that works. Let's just keep doing this.
And also, like, being under contract and having the gig in a TV show is that, you know, you've got to remain that character. And it's interesting to me, because this doesn't happen in my relationship with you as an actor, is that because I didn't watch that TV show, you don't live there for me.
Right, totally.
And I think that ensemble was also big enough that, and the show was sort of weird and it was its own thing,
yeah,
that it doesn't seem like anybody from that cast, not to me at least, is like, how's that guy going to do anything else other than that character?
Yeah.
Because, well, it seems like everyone did.
You know, you find out, there's a very tricky thing about self-perception when you're working in this business, because it's very much based on perception.
Mm-hmm.
So how people see you is sort of how they're willing to cast you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it starts to affect your, if you're not careful, starts to affect how you view yourself.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the nature of a TV show is that it's meant to be repetitive, mm-hmm, so that you can check in at every time. It's meant to be comfortable. You know, my character is like a loving, funny, schlubby husband.
Right.
There's not going to be like the surprise episode where you find out I'm a cheater.
Right.
You know, yeah, what I mean? So you kind of fall into this thing.
People, the viewers want that consistency. That's what they love, those the characters.
Yeah. And
so you can't just make him a monster all of a sudden.
No. And there's a lot of value to that. You know, as I've gained distance from the show, and I really like road tripping.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you travel to small towns where people come up and they say, hey, you know, watching your TV show got me through Iraq, or watching.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It's a really, really special thing. I think that while you're doing it and you're so artistically driven, you have this feeling of, oh, I should be pushing the limits out there.
Uh-huh.
I found out there is like real value to, you know, a sitcom.
Sure. No. Like, you know, even with this in its own way, you know, people listen to, you know, me talk about my own struggles, whether it's, recovery or my own neurotic problems and my relationship problems. It's like, I get a lot of emails and a lot of people like, you know, I go, you know, you help me through a dark time.
Yeah.
And why isn't that enough? You know, it's got to be, and it's a beautiful thing. I never anticipated that. And it's something when you're in your own loop, you're like, well, I don't know if I'm doing a good job or if this is like a great job or if this is, but then all of a sudden you realize like, you have no idea how you're affecting other people in a good way.
That's right.
And it's a beautiful thing. So, all right. I Love You, Man. I watched that movie. I saw that.
That's a fun one.
It's a good movie.
I've done a bunch of things with Rudd, and I feel like he and I just work well together. Our sense of humor is bounce off each other.
Well,
really
you're both you're soft guys.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah,
you know,
totally. We don't have a lot of machismo.
Right. Yeah. So there's something about that.
Although
he's willing to get pretty vulnerable.
Oh, totally. Yeah. He also got really buff for Ant-Man.
Did he? Oh, I haven't seen.
He's jacked. Oh, he looks like a lightweight boxer.
Oh, really? I gotta get that. I gotta get a trainer. Do you work out?
You know what? I'm starting to now. Like I'm more fit than I've been, but my body is still like what a fit guy looked like in those ads from the 50s. You know where
the weird broad chest.
Yeah, and like you're allowed to be a little pot-bellied. Yeah,
right. And you lift your chest up a lot. Like,
yeah. Like I look like I should squash nerds.
Well, you're a big guy.
Yeah.
The sort of like you moving into these smaller movies, like with I saw Jeff Who Lives at Home.
Oh,
that's Duplass's, right?
Yeah, totally.
And that was an interesting small movie, right? But
I
that
love
did
that
pretty
movie.
Well.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure how it did, but I know that I felt like there was something really special about that movie.
There was, because the character felt like it was, you know, it was a compromised character and a character in a sort of emotional struggle that kind of ends up transcending and being the hero of the story. But that guy seemed very familiar.
Yeah, it's a guy we know the guy. Yeah. Like he feels like there is more to life and there's secrets around every corner.
Yeah.
And as a result, he lives in his basement.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
It's that guy. But in that movie, he turns out to be right.
Yeah. And I watched the end of Tour.
Oh, you did.
I did. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
It was great. You were great.
Thank you.
It was. This was the one you were hoping for.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did it come about, this movie, to play David Foster Wallace?
You know, okay, well, the first answer is I don't know what happens behind the walls of an agency.
Sure.
But my experience was the script got sent to me and they...
It got sent to you.
Yes, it got sent to me and they asked if it's something that I felt like I could do, if I thought I could play that part. And I read it and I really did. The themes of the movie just really resonated with me. It's a lot about what we're talking about outside of the comedy, about actually being the person. What happens when things are going as well as they possibly can and you still feel the same?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this movie takes place over the last 4 days of the, it's about David Foster Wallace and, it's the last 4 days of the Infinite Jest book tour. This book was like called The Voice of a Generation. He wrote it for years and years. It's 1,000+ pages. It came out, did as well as it could do. And, he didn't feel better.
Right. And in, like, it's one of those books that is revered that I have not read.
Yeah, that's most people's experience with it I've met.
Did you read it?
Yeah, of course.
Did you read it before you got this opportunity?
No, absolutely not. And when I bought it at the bookstore, I bought it at like a little indie bookstore, and there was like a ghost world kind of girl behind the counter, mm-hmm. and I set Infinite Jest down, and she said, "Ugh, Infinite Jest. Every guy I've ever slept with has an unread copy on his bookshelf."
Yeah. So you read that?
Yeah, I did. I read it with some guys who worked at the bookstore, actually.
What do you mean you read it with them?
We did a book club where we would each read. We would go off and we would read 100 pages, and then we would get together on Sundays and talk about what we had read.
And how far away were you from shooting?
I had 4 months.
Okay.
I had 4 months to get ready.
Uh-huh. And, well, this is sort of what we were talking about, you know, the character in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And this seems to be like a perfect sort of synchronicity for you, in the sense that, you know, through all these years of craving to do this deeper work as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, you're given the opportunity, and comedically you sort of dealt with, you know, some of the issues you were dealing with. But this character, you know... How close to your experience was it?
It was at this point in my life, it felt like kismet when we started shooting. I had gotten sober. I got sober 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I'm like a year and a half sober at that point. And my TV show was coming to an end. And I was at a real moment of, what do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
There's a line in the movie that is kind of verbatim what David Foster Wallace said during this interview. But he said, I have to face the reality now of being 34 years old alone in a room with a piece of paper. And that's really what I felt like at this point. Like, my safety net was gone. The fact that I have a financial safety net didn't really apply to what I felt.
It doesn't, does it?
No.
Right.
Of course not.
Yeah.
Well, not of course not. I suppose looking from outside of it, you would think, of course it does.
It actually makes it, yeah, for a lot of people are sort of like, what are you complaining about? But The truth of the matter is that the sad thing when you're in that position is that you do have that, and then you have these feelings, and they're almost compounded. They're like, well, what the, because then you're like, what the fuck is wrong with me? I can eat wherever I want and buy that car if I want to.
This is what the movie is dealing with, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, what the movie is it's basically a transcript of this interview that a guy called David Lipsky did with David Foster Wallace, where Rolling Stone sent him out and spent the last 4 days of the book tour with him. And
well, it's interesting because, like, the one thing I noticed about the movie in retrospect is, like, who is this movie really about?
Right.
Like, because, you walk away from it and you're like, was that about Lipsky?
Yeah.
But then you sort of like, you go to the other place and it's equally about both of you, I think. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I actually think that it is about a theme.
Uh-huh.
That if you treat yourself and listen to a speech that David Foster Wallace gave called This Is Water. It was the Kenyan commencement speech.
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
Yeah. It is addressing the exact theme that we're talking about in this interview, which is, if you are where do you place your value? And what is going to address this itch that we keep trying to scratch that's telling us we're not there,
mm-hmm.
that we're not enough?
Mm-hmm.
If it's success, you'll never be successful enough. And if it's money, you'll never have enough money.
Right.
If it's talent, you'll never be adored enough. You have to find something else. And I just really related to that.
And at the point in this movie, like, you don't get the sense that he necessarily did, right?
Yeah, I think that right when you catch him at this point, he is a man who is doing everything he can to feel normal. I had access to the actual audio of these uh-huh. interviews, and he refers to them at one point as mental gymnastics, that he is using every tool at his disposal to feel okay.
Wow, because it's like, it's such an intimate, you know, movie.
Yeah.
And it's a little odd in that you feel that these are transcripts, like, you know, that the script is taken from real conversations.
Yeah.
And what I imagine the challenge to be, and this is a challenge that I think that just, you know, when you talk to writers in real life, is that what I found myself doing is you know, this guy's a genius,
mm-hmm.
but now he's talking about Pop-Tarts.
Right.
So what do you bring to that as an actor? You saw the dialogue, and there are some meaty parts where he explains his emotions and his sensibility and the sort of tension between, you know, he sees this guy who's completely insecure. And I know that Lipsky guy.
Yeah. Do you know him personally?
No. Oh. But I know that character.
Of course. Because it's us 5 years ago.
Right.
Or however long
right.
it is for sure. You know? That's what I think is, to me, that's what the movie... That was the lens I saw it through, was a guy talking to himself on the beginning end of the tunnel.
Uh-huh.
Lipsky is looking up at David Foster Wallace saying, God, it must be great to be you. You must feel great. You must feel terrific. What's it like to be so famous? And David Foster Wallace looking back at him saying, kid, be careful what you wish for. Trust me, if you get to where I am, you're not going to feel better.
Yeah. Well, and that's sad.
Yeah, it's sad, but it's very real. And right. I think that one of the reasons David Foster Wallace resonates with people is it is a man who had the vocabulary to express something that we feel and maybe are too scared to talk about openly. or too
which
scared,
is which the existential loneliness that persists.
Yeah, which is that you're promised that by our culture that if you achieve X, Y, or Z, or obtain X, Y, or Z, or watch this marathon of Real Housewives, that you're going to feel better. And it turns out that that's not true. And people are really operating under that assumption and get to the destination and find out that it's vacant.
But it's rare that a person can investigate that loneliness like he did. Like, that's I think that, you know, sadly, some people just percolate along with a mild feeling of dissatisfaction or anxiety that they can't pinpoint. But he decided to explore the underpinnings of existence in relation to these expectations and the onslaught of sensations available.
Infinite Jest, when I read it, it's three-pronged. There are basically three storylines that are interweaving. One is about recovery in Boston. About AA. One is about this entertainment that has been obtained by terrorists that is so entertaining that people who watch it basically become zombified.
Right.
This is like a dystopian future.
Yeah.
And the third is about a tennis camp, which is achievement. These young kids who are told, like, if you don't make it to the pros, you're nothing. That's right. The whole reason you're here.
My brother went to that camp.
Really?
Yeah, Nick Bollettieri's.
Oh, my gosh.
Is in Florida.
Okay.
My brother didn't make it.
Yeah. 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 Well, that's the thing. Most people don't. So if the criteria of success is that if you don't make it, you're a failure, then a lot of people are walking around feeling shitty. You know what I mean? And
sure.
So,
and just medicating that one way or the other.
That's right.
Or expressing their anger in weird ways.
Yeah, because all three of those are medicating. Whether it's booze, whether it's just plopping yourself in front of the TV, or whether it's this intense pursuit of achievement, they're all ways to kind of push off, how do I actually feel?
Mm-hmm. So outside of reading the book,
yeah,
like it's all made tragic and relevant by the fact that David Foster Wallace killed himself.
That's right.
And that, you know, you're looking at this movie, that this time capsule, that, and you can't help but, like, sort of, what are the indicators? You know, like, and I imagine you as an actor, you know, knowing, you know how he ended up years later, you know, this is part of that trajectory somehow, right?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know how you prepare.
Well,
here's
the thing. Here's what I thought to myself is that if me 5 years ago saw me now, I would be unrecognizable.
Why? How much were you drinking?
I was drinking quite a bit. I got to the point where I felt like I was going to collapse under the weight of it. I felt very trapped. I felt like...
Isolated, you mean? Or by the liquor?
Well, I felt certainly isolated. And I also, I mean, I would just very simply wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to drink today. And... By the midday, I was drinking.
Yeah. Oh, so you had it pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean,
so it wasn't a party.
No. It was not a party in any way.
Did it start as a party? Or were you always?
My hunch is it always starts as a party. Right? Yeah, no one's like.
And then all of a sudden, I'd like you to meet the monster. Yeah. I hope you had a good time at the party. Now you're working for this guy.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And you've lost control. You
right.
know? And I got really lucky in that I had a real moment of clarity where I said to myself, I want to be the best version of myself. I just got really lucky that happened.
Was it a dark day?
Yeah, it was a dark day. I had something bad happen. I had not been drinking for a little while, for months.
Yeah.
And I decided, you know what? I'm going to drink. And so I didn't have... booze in the house for myself at this point. I had a case of rosé for guests.
Right.
It was summertime.
Yeah.
And so I decided I'll have a glass of rosé.
Right. One glass.
I don't even like rosé.
Yeah.
And so basically it turned into a weekend where by the end of it, I was surrounded by these empty bottles of rosé. And I thought to myself, this is not for pleasure.
Right.
I don't like rosé.
Yeah.
This is something else is going on.
And there's no end to it.
Yeah, there's just no end to it. Right. You know what the thing is about, for me, that I realized about booze, is that I am not going to win. Mm-hmm. This is, they're not going to stop making booze. I can't drink it all.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for me, it's like fighting Mike Tyson.
Right.
And I realized at that point, the best strategy for me is not to get in the ring.
Yeah, and it's weird that when you're introduced to that craving thing, that's the most fucked up thing about having a drinking problem or a drug problem is like the idea that like, yeah, okay, I can stop.
Yeah.
And then you stop for a little while. But then like that day where you're like, I'm going to drink, like that thing that wakes up in you where like that weird, like unquenchable kind of like, oh, I gotta, ugh, that when you meet that thing, you're like, this is a fucking problem.
Yeah. And you know, the thing that you're not told because it you don't discuss this openly, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
But if anyone out there is like suffering
right.
or has these feelings, I don't know how I'm going to stop. It, once you say to yourself or just to somebody else, I need help.
Yeah.
It unfolds.
Yeah, it comes.
Yeah,
it just dozens unfolds. Of people willing to help.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, good for you, man. It's a great step. And how about it when that day where you got enough sober time and you realize like, no, I don't really want it anymore.
Yeah.
It's a great day.
Oh, man. I can tell you what happened. So this is about 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, you spend like the first month, 2 months thinking, what do I do now?
Yeah. When you stop drinking.
Well, just right. my sure. activities.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah. And you were kind of like, you were out in the world being drunk.
Yeah. Well, I was good at it.
Well, can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah, sure.
I just want some validation on this. I heard that you got into the habit of getting on stage and just saying, is there any women that want to fuck me? And giving out your phone number. Is that true?
No, that is a bastardization of a great comedy bit. No, what it was I had written a song that I would open. I opened a couple concerts with. I opened for Maroon 5, and I sang it once with Glenn Hansard in the Swell season.
Okay.
That was actually a very funny song. So it was a very nuanced.
Oh, okay.
It was a very nuanced version of that.
Okay, okay.
And the phone number was fake.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's so funny how like it finally got to me was like, yeah, he's just... Fucking,
he's just
like,
going for it.
Yeah, he's just like putting out his phone number and just like, yeah, Hollywood, man.
Well, that was sort of the desired effect, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, so a month into not drinking,
right?
I was driving down the street. Mm-hmm. I was driving back from San Diego Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like, I was listening to the oldie station. And all of a sudden, I realized... I was singing along to Rock Around the Clock.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, I feel good. I feel pretty happy. I've seen this in movies where people sing in the car in a real happy mood. And I've never looked back. Like, it was the best decision I ever made for myself.
It's great.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Thanks.
You seem clear. I can't imagine you all foggy. And you must have been kind of a, like, how would you describe yourself as a drunk? Did people want to hang around you?
Yeah, but you surround yourself with people who want to hang around that
party.
Guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was never a party kind of guy.
Right.
I was more like how I pictured the Rat Pack to be.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, you know, all of these things are illusions that you're sort of fed from like movies and TV, but I was more like that.
I remember one time being at the Improv, and I remember Jonah came in with a bunch of guys. Were you running with him?
No, I don't think so. Not at the time, man.
Oh, okay. But you guys friends?
Yeah, yeah. He's a great buddy.
Well, you guys both seem to have a light around you these days. Like when I talked to him, he was very sort of
really
focused and upbeat. And I'd heard some things that he could be a little difficult, but he was like such a sweetheart.
Jonah and I have talked a lot about life stuff. You know, there's very few friends that you have who are around your age.
Mm-hmm.
Who Jonah is doing amazingly. The two Academy Award nominations and things. So, but. Where you can talk about feeling weird about stuff that's going on, about success, you know,
and
there's
celebrity.
Yeah, I can imagine it's a pretty annoying thing to have your more successful friend say, "Boy, it's so frustrating being successful." So
I have a relationship like that.
Yeah, you have a limited audience of people that you can be, you know, honest with about that.
That's so true.
And, you know, and it takes a big heart and a good friend to show up for that guy. Yeah, it's an interesting thing because, you know, I have relationships with people, obviously, a lot. I'm work out of my garage and you know, I have this show. So I have a lot of friends who are big, you know, who are stars. And, you know, I don't have many friends, but, you know, there are people in my life where I just realized this recently that, you know, I'm pretty close friends with a guy who's pretty big. And there's very few people he can really talk to in a way.
Yeah, well, you can talk about stuff that is common ground.
Right, right. But to really express...
People are all the same, right? Yeah. And no matter how well you're doing, you are going to have feelings of not being enough. You're going to have feelings of dissatisfaction. Uh-huh. And it's tough, I imagine, to find people to talk about that with if basically you sound like you're whining.
Or if you're seen as the guy that should have everything.
Yes,
you have to have real friends is basically what it is.
Yeah, well, it's codified like in myth from the beginning of time.
Sure.
This is a universal feeling. The king feels the same way. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And who's going to feel bad for the king?
Yeah, that's right.
Fuck that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's the king.
Totally.
So, well, that's a beautiful sort of thing that this role, you know, comes to you where you can sort of process these emotions through this guy.
Well, I felt like sort of in the way that we're talking now, I felt like what the movie was a real opportunity. It's an extension to me of the themes of Infinite Jest, of This Is Water. Let's talk about this stuff. It is okay. I feel like when you read Infinite Jest, there is like a distress beacon going out saying, does anyone else feel this way? It's okay. I feel this way.
Sure.
Do you guys?
Right.
And I watched the movie, and I feel like James Ponsold and Donald Margulies, the writer, did an amazing job of... It could just be two smart guys talking, and it would be such a boring movie. But it gets at these themes, and that's what resonated with me.
And it's interesting, the way it got to those themes was by essentially not making it just two smart guys talking, because a lot of the conversations were about pussy,
yeah,
and they were about, you know, food.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Going to, like, because that's what's really interesting about the movie.
Cool.
Is those choices of when and where the deep, smart shit comes out so it doesn't overrun the movie.
Yeah. Well, you need the audience to want to be in the backseat of that car.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to want to be on that road trip. It's a 4-day road trip, and it could be exhausting if it wasn't fun. And you listen to the tapes, and honestly, like, the one that I like the most that doesn't make it into the movie is Hanson. Remember Hanson, the band?
Yeah,
they came on the radio, and you hear David Foster Wallace for about 3 minutes dissect Hanson.
Yeah.
And you're hearing the smartest guy, you know, of his generation talk about Hanson.
In a positive way?
Yeah, just in a, know, pop culture analyzing way.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And that to me is the fun of it. You get to hear some really, really beautiful insight in some really mundane things.
And it's interesting because, you know, Eisenberg's very intense.
Yeah.
And I don't like for you to kind of, you know, hold character around that. What was it like working with him?
It was the most intimate experience I've ever had acting, honestly. Uh-huh. There's great supporting cast.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of the movie is Jesse and I.
Yeah.
Alone together.
Had you worked with him before?
No, I had never met him before.
Because he's an intense character.
He's intense. He is incredibly quick and funny. We were together in our first meeting and someone asked me how I got started writing. And I said, well, you know, I sort of had to create my own material. No one was knocking down my door to play Captain America.
Yeah.
To which Jesse just really quietly said, no, but you could probably play the captain of a weaker country. So he's that smart, you know, and quick. And he's also the most prepared actor that I've ever met.
Really?
Yeah. I was just astounded at how ready and thoughtful he was about the script. And so we were staying at the same motel, like a Residence Inn, in the freezing cold. And we would drive together.
Indiana? Where was it shot?
We shot in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Oh, Michigan, yeah.
In the heart of winter. It was like -15 degrees or something. Yeah. And we would drive together in the morning to work and go over our scenes for the day. Then we would act all day together for like 15 hours. And it was interesting because it paralleled the movie. We were acting with each other, but we were also acting against each other.
Uh-huh.
Like each of us wanted to win the scene.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then we would drive home and like unwind and talk about what we had, what the characters had talked about in the movie,
mm-hmm.
get like a donut at 2 a.m. mm-hmm. and then go to bed and get together in the morning and do it all over again. It was the best.
And did you feel like you now you're friends?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great friend. He's really terrific. He also still makes fun of me. I gained quite a bit of weight for the movie
because mm-hmm.
we had pictures of David Foster Wallace during that period that mm-hmm. I just tried to match. So I was like shoveling food into my mouth. And Jesse loves old-time candy.
Yeah.
Here's a little fun fact for you. And so I sent him a video like a month ago of an old-time candy shop
yeah.
just going through, showing the candy, and he sent me back a text, thinking that this would be, hey, buddy, I miss you. He sent me back a text that said, stop sending me video of your colonoscopy.
There's a place down right here on York that sells all the old-time candy.
Isn't it the best?
Yeah, like you don't even think they make it anymore.
Yeah,
totally. Galco's. They sell all these sodas from around the world.
Yeah, it's the best.
Well, so what do you take away? Like, obviously, this is, you know, about to be seen.
Yeah.
What's your feelings?
My feelings are I want to do more movies like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I want to do...
And you can.
Yeah, I think I can.
I think that's the weird maturity to... You know, this transition you're in, you know, emotionally and lifestyle wise, but the fact that you have made, you know, this, the amount of success you have and the freedom you have. I mean, the only thing you're up against is these expectations that might not even be yours.
That's right. Hmm. Well, it's an interesting thing because we filmed the movie, you know, a year and a few months ago now, a year and change.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I have been living career-wise a year ahead of the business.
Right.
So it's been a really interesting year of trying to be patient and have some faith in the movie.
After you're done. So it's been out of your hands
I've just been waiting.
A year. And what have you been doing?
I've been writing. Been writing a lot.
What are you working on?
I'm writing one of the new Lego movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm writing that. I'm writing my books.
Isn't that interesting, though, that, like, you know, these like, childhood passions or the things, you know, that, you know, the weird kind of turn of events that drove you to a Muppet movie, I imagine now, like, you're a go-to guy for a whole different thing than you ever expected.
You know, I have a part of me that hasn't changed that makes me, I think, like, uniquely good for that stuff because I have... I now have the skills of a professional writer.
Right.
But there is, I know like what satisfies me as a 12-year-old kid.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I know what I want to see. That part of me that's still 12.
Right. So what, the premiere's tomorrow?
The premiere's tonight. I'm going to go put on a suit after this and like just enjoy it. It's at the Writers Guild in Beverly Hills.
And who's going? Like, is Judd coming and, you know, friends or?
I have my parents coming.
Yeah.
And I have some friends coming. Uh-huh. And I have a lovely girlfriend named Alexis. She's coming.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it's a really intimate movie and experience. And to watch it with people I care about is the best.
So it's not really a public premiere. It's going to be an in-house thing or?
No, I think it is public. Uh-huh. But I invited people who are very close to me.
Oh, it's okay to invent people that are close to
you. I've done that too. That ended a few years ago.
It's great talking to you, man.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
See, that guy's a sweet guy. Nice guy. Love that guy. Love talking to Jason Segel. I think we can be friends. That's what I decided. I'm going to try to be friends with Jason Segel. I'm going to try to be friends with Adam Goldberg. I think those are appropriate friends for me, don't you? Am I overstepping? Am I overstepping as the host of a show in my house? WTFpod.com/calendar. Those dates are in September, early September, the 2nd, 4th, and 5th. And there's other stuff there. I put all the artist names on all the posters. All the poster art there now has the artist names. I felt like a dick. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I'm like, why don't I put the artist names on there? What kind of bullshit is that? They're artists. They made this art. So they're on there now.